This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll bring you our conversation with Professor Joy Piper in a moment. But first, Mayor Joe Stahura has followed through on his promise to resign. The city attorney in the city of Whiting announced yesterday evening that Stahura tendered his resignation as mayor to the clerk of the Lake County Circuit Court. And City Council President Chris Sarvadius is going to assume the duties of mayor of Whiting until the position is filled by a Democratic Party caucus, and that could happen within the next 30 days. Joe Stahura will appear in federal court next week in Hammond to answer to mail and tax fraud charges in connection with diverting re-election campaign money to his family's personal use. He also admitted to filing incorrect income tax returns. He agreed late last week to resign as mayor. The U.S. Attorney's Office agreed to recommend that Stahura receive leniency in return for his cooperation with investigators who've been looking into his case. Well, many people consider wearing a mask to be cumbersome, but we rely on them before and even during and probably after the pandemic has passed here around our country and here in Indiana. A Purdue University nursing professor, though, has taken a look at the past and particularly looking at the knowledge of medicine and technology that might help us make it through the pandemic because we have to wear masks. And we have with us to talk about it a clinical assistant professor of nursing from Purdue University's College of Health and Human Services, Professor Joy Piper. And thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Now, you have the opportunity to be able to teach a couple courses about healthcare history and the wartime influences on healthcare. So obviously, that includes looking at World War I, which is the one that we seem to hear reference to the most about the huge flu epidemic, pandemic that happened back then, and some of the parallels, I'm supposed to COVID-19 now.
Yes, and so you've probably seen pictures of masks being worn in the Spanish flu of 1918. So, yes, very similar methods that they were using to try to help curb the spread of the illness.
I understand you and your colleague, Rebecca Johnson, had a chance to go over all the data and talk in more detail about the 1918 pandemic and about the use of masks and kind of the parallels we have today. And I guess some good do's and don'ts maybe we've learned from the past about properly wearing masks.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the first reason for masks was really source control, so meaning that the person wearing the mask wore it so they would not spread infection to other people. And so that was really kind of the late 1800s where you saw that. It wasn't until the early 1900s, again, around that time of the Spanish flu, where you started to see people wearing the mask to protect themselves from other individuals. So, yeah, we definitely can draw on the past to help understand what's good today and really our understanding of germ theory and infection control has come so far. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely things that help you be successful in wearing your mask versus just putting it on for just because of a rule doesn't mean that you're actually doing it in a way that's in any way effective.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you have come up with four basic tips on how to properly wear a mask. Would you go through those, please, for us?
Sure. So some of the things you want to think about are finding a mask that is easy to wear. So we want it to be something that's comfortable, but that doesn't mean that it's funny to see people say, oh, I need a mask that's super breathable. Well, yes, you need to be able to breathe through it, but you also need it to be, close to your skin so that you are preventing that, too much of your exhalation from being going out on the sides of the mask. So mm-hmm. something that's comfortable for you to wear. It should have a couple layers because if you think about it, think about that Swiss cheese effect. You want to have as many layers as possible blocking any holes in that fabric. And so your nice higher thread count fabric is really good to do that. You want to make sure it stays dry. That's really important. And that's hard, especially in the summer, right? We're sweating. And I can speak to as I'm lecturing, I'm talking, and that mask is collecting all of my spit. So mm-hmm. I have to change throughout the day. You definitely want to keep it dry because wet fabric transfers infection germs easier. And then when you're taking it on and off, you want to be sure you're grabbing where you have the strings on the ears and pulling it away from your face and then folding it in half so the inside layers are on the outside. So I should say the two outside layers come together to keep that, quote, dirty side not exposed to anything. And then you definitely need to do hand hygiene afterwards, whether that's washing your hands or using a hand sanitizer.
I know that we hear a lot about the N95 masks. Is it wise to have those, or are those really specialty masks that are mainly for healthcare workers, right?
Right. I mean, if you have access to an N95, that's great. That is the best protection that you can get in an easy way right now in terms of cost. However, you won't see them too much for sale because they really are being saved for the healthcare workers who are much more likely to come in contact. They're the ones who are actually caring for the patients with COVID. So it's harder to find those on the market right now. However, I'd say if you are a patient, perhaps you're undergoing cancer treatment and you're having to go to the facility off and on, I'd say if you're able to find an N95, that's great to give you an extra level of protection.
How about these masks that have valves in them? Is that a good idea to have one of those, or do they just basically get in the way?
Oh, that's a good question. Most times when you see a mask with a valve, so you'll even find those at like Lowe's or Home Depot.
Right.
Those are primarily for, as you would imagine, more like construction type work. So they have a valve that's a one-way valve so that as that individual breathes in, air is filtered, but it does not filter the air when it's exhaled because it's really primarily to be used around dust and things like that. So most masks on the market that have a valve are a one-way valve, and they're really not offering protection for anyone around the user because everything that's exhaled is not filtered.
We're talking with Purdue University Professor Joy Piper. She teaches courses in healthcare history and wartime influences on healthcare. That's why she and her colleague Rebecca Johnson have done a lot of research into the 1918 flu pandemic and of course, the protective measures that neighborhoods and communities took back then, including wearing masks to try to reduce the spread of the disease. Well, you've talked about some interesting points about how to wear the mask and how you should store it, especially if you have to take it home to get it washed, that is. Do you find that it's wise to maybe have more than one mask on hand, especially if you have to wear it all day long?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great idea. I recommend having a couple masks. I have about probably 10 masks, and that's because during a day I will have to change. And like you said, so if it gets wet, I need to change. And then to carry those throughout the day, it's good if you have, like a plastic bag or something you can put your used mask in until you're able to get home to clean it. But having a few of them is a nice idea to change during the day and then also so you don't have to do your laundry every single day to get those washed. It gives you a little more flexibility and really ensures that you always have a clean mask.
I know my family has a number of masks. They have a plastic bag, just a regular old plastic bag we keep on a lavatory in one of the bathrooms. We put the used masks in that, and then we collect a bunch of them, and then we put them in the wash, or sometimes we wash them by hand. You can do it either way, right? They don't have to be laundered in the machine, but just as long as they're properly clean, I suppose.
You got it, exactly. So, I mean, really, primarily, you're seeing masks made out of cotton, and so you want to follow the washing instructions based on the type of fabric you have. So if you're doing it through a washing machine, you just want to get that highest heat setting that's appropriate for that fabric. Same with drying. And if you're hand washing it, that's absolutely appropriate as well. You just want to use, again, that hot, although not burning your hands, water, and then laying them flat to dry if you're air drying them so that it helps keep the appropriate shape of the mask.
Now, I've noticed lately that in some of the stores here in Northwest Indiana in particular, and I'm sure probably around the West Lafayette campus and in Lafayette too, I've been seeing for sale disposable masks, which is not unusual. You'll buy them in maybe packets of 10 or something like that. The only thing that makes me wonder is that the ones I've seen are made in China. Do you think they're probably safe to wear? Are they pre-sensitized or pre-sterilized, we should say, ahead of time before they ship them out?
That's a valid question. I don't have any concern about buying a mask from China. What I would do is make sure that you look at how many layers that mask has, and they're usually pretty good on the outside of the box of telling you. Most disposable masks have three layers, which is good. The World Health Organization recommends three, so that is ideal. And I would go more by that. They are typically not sterilized. Even in the operating room, we don't wear sterile masks. Mm-hmm. We wear clean masks because we're not, you know, having it come in contact with the patient. We're using it simply to block our sputum from coming out onto the patient in the sterile field. So to me, I would not have any concern about a mask from an area that has had a higher incidence of COVID. It's not the type of virus that we're seeing is staying in fabric for super long periods of time. Mm-hmm. So that's my current advice on that. I have not heard any concerns about that.
Well, we've been getting advice about wearing a mask, about the type of mask, how to take care of it, since we're all wearing masks these days during the pandemic. We're getting the advice from a surgical nurse who is a professor of nursing at Purdue University, Professor Joy Piper, with us. She teaches classes at the Purdue College of Health and Human Services on the West Lafayette campus. And thank you for being with us to talk about the very important subject of wearing a mask.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A Purdue University researcher is going to be involved along with others on a webinar tomorrow, Thursday, and he'll present his findings from a new study that looks into the economic impact of wind energy on Indiana communities. And we now have a chance to find out more from Professor Russell Hilberry. He's an agricultural economist at Purdue University down on the West Lafayette campus. And thank you for joining us on the program today, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about the organizations that are putting on this webinar presentation on Thursday and how you've gotten connected with them.
So the organizations are a conservative lobby groups, I guess, mm-hmm. with grassroots backing that are interested in seeing alternative energy advance, you know, more on the conservative side of politics. So a lot of times I think people think that this is only the left side of politics is in favor of renewable energy, and these people are coming at it more from the point of view of conservative political leanings. They commissioned a study from our group, the Purdue Extension. There's a Purdue Extension office that does community development work, mm-hmm. and they were interested in how wind energy affects community development, and that's how Purdue got involved.
When the group gets together to talk on the topics that you're asked to talk on, in particular, in this case here, I'm putting together the data that'll go together for the report that's coming to be presented at the webinar, what kinds of things do you and your colleagues typically look for as far as looking for what kind of actual impact we actually see because of wind energy and how it does make a real serious economic difference here in Indiana?
So I think one of the interesting things of looking at this at a county level, which is something new at this study, we kind of focused on the county level, is that we now have experience with enough experience with wind energy, some counties taking wind and other counties not taking wind, that you can kind of see how wind energy affects counties by looking at what happens to counties on average. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you see that there are sort of significant increases in the average incomes of counties that accept wind power. That comes through payments to the landowners for the use of the turbines. It comes from high-paying jobs that people are working in these sectors. And it also comes through payments to county governments who can then use those funds to spend, you know, either reduce taxes or increase public services.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty obvious that if you travel north, in particular, of West Lafayette, if you travel on I-65 or even on U.S. 41, whichever route you decide to take, you can't help but see the wind turbines. And especially if you're traveling at night, all you can see are these bright red lights flashing at you. Well, of course, you know that the wind turbines are attached to the lights, so you know they're up there. These acres and acres of big flashing lights sometimes and during the day of the wind turbines. Are we finding that these large-scale wind energy projects are paying off as much as they've been touted to? And do you think that's why there's an interest to set up more of them, in particular here in Indiana?
So those particular turbines are in White County and in neighboring Benton County.
Mm-hmm.
And those two counties, there's been, you know, the report talks about those two counties in particular as being the sort of where the first turbines came and where the most turbines are currently. Those counties, there's quite a bit about, you know, county finances and what the workers are paid and things like that from those counties specifically. Now, what the kind of broader public policy issue is you know, the turbine technology has advanced so that counties outside of that particular area of Indiana are now possible hosts of turbines. And so this is not just an issue for Benton and White counties where the wind was particularly strong for the older technology, but now it's becoming an issue that's relevant to counties across the sort of northern two-thirds of the state.
Mm-hmm.
There's suitable wind.
Do you find that it's these technology changes that the turbines that are put up pick up wind more subtly than maybe before? You had to have a lot of gusty winds to keep the turbines going and in turn creating the electricity, that we're finding the new technology is really what is driving the projects, and even what as far even as far south from there as Indianapolis, I would imagine.
Yes, there are a number of technological advances, but the main one is that the turbines are getting taller.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're up higher, they get more steady and higher winds. And so they're able to kind of produce electricity more often and produce more electricity overall. And so they become more profitable than they were in the past. And that also means that you don't have to be in this place where Benton and White County are, where the winds are particularly strong at the height of 80 meters, when the turbines are now 100 meters or even slightly higher than that.
Wow. Are we finding, too, that utilities are showing much more interest in these projects because you can get the winds going even higher and more stably? And as you say, you can generate more electricity, so they're obviously looking at that to help recoup their costs, I would think.
So there are utilities that are interested in this, but
mm-hmm.
A lot of this power is sold through contracts to firms. I think Amazon has a farm in Benton County where they have purchased the electricity from that farm. And so these are often they're selling energy to firms that are you know, wanting to lock in 30 years of power at a certain price.
Right.
So that's kind of how it's usually financed.
Now, you mentioned here about businesses being very interested in and taking advantage of this very inexpensive, relatively so, wind power turning into electricity. Are we finding that residents and even whole communities are looking to this as an option?
Well, for as far as purchasing electricity goes, the individuals would usually buy from their utility provider.
Right.
And the utility provider would also, you know, be buying wind power as well. I just think that in this context of wind, it's important to understand that it's not all going through the utilities. I mean, they're moving the electricity, but the purchases are often done by firms and nonprofits and other organizations that want to buy wind energy power.
We're talking with Purdue University agricultural economist Russell Hilberry. He and some other folks involved are involved in a webinar presentation that's going to be held tomorrow, Thursday, about a new study that is looking into the economic impact of wind energy on Hoosier communities. And Professor Hilberry, are you finding that had a chance to talk with people, individuals, residents, as well as other business people in these areas to find out what they think about wind energy?
Yes. So one of the challenges of this study is that it took place during the kind of COVID restrictions, and we had hoped to kind of go out and do focus groups. We ended up speaking by webinar with various people. One of the limitations of this study is that you know, we hope to speak to some people in communities that were more opposed to wind power, but we got very little sort of feedback from people in those communities.
Yeah.
We did hear a lot from people in Benton and White counties, and they were quite favorable towards wind power in their communities.
Mm-hmm. Are a lot of these people that have given that response to you in focus groups or whatever it may be, individual comments, are these people in many cases local government officials? Maybe they're looking at ways to change the zoning laws to be able to allow larger wind farms to be set up?
So the officials in Benton and White County, they have a lot of experience with wind power, and they were kind of sort of, they talked about how they felt it had changed their communities. There was kind of a special focus on how much revenue was earned by the county. You know, I think that's important for a lot of county governments. You know, the report also kind of, we got information from the web and articles, local press articles and things, about opposition to wind power, and there is quite a lot of that in Indiana. And you know, one thing that we had hoped to learn more about is how communities come to this decision to oppose or to accept wind power. And you know, we have some data on that. I don't know that we've kind of come to firm conclusions about how that happened.
Yeah.
So a bit of a mystery.
Well,
so.
It sounds like that obviously you're off to a very good start with this particular report that's going to be presented at the webinar. Have you and your colleagues there at Purdue University on West Lafayette campus decided to do more studies or to follow through and more completely with this particular topic?
Yes, this is the main report that we'll have for kind of that's aimed at the public. I intend to do some more work. I have a graduate student, and we're doing some work, kind of technical, statistical work, to see if we can learn more about, you know, how the experiences of counties differ if they accept wind or don't in terms of economic impact.
Let's hope that this webinar turns out to be a very successful one. It looks like you're off to a great start with the information you've gathered and the reports that you're going to put together to the folks that are going to participate in this event. Once again, this is a webinar presentation that's going to be put on Thursday by the Indiana Conservative Alliance for Energy. The Land and Liberty Coalition are getting together to do this, and they have asked agricultural economist Russell Hilberry from Purdue University and his colleagues to put together the information from their report. And we hope you have some great questions that are asked and something that gets turned around, like you say, in more fodder that you can put together for any further use. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today, sir. The city of Gary is embarking on a goal to reduce its carbon footprint, and the mayor is asking all residents to be involved. Let me find out more on this from Sharon Jackson.
The City of Gary Common Council recently passed the City of Gary Climate Resilience and Recovery Resolution. The move calls for the city to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions in accordance with the goals of the United States Climate Mayors. Brenda Scott Henry is in charge of the Gary Office of Sustainability and Environmental Affairs. The office will lead the city in the Climate Resiliency Program, which includes a detailed climate action plan. Gary Mayor Jerome Prince is calling the resolution an all-hands-on deck project. He says every Gary resident needs to contribute by completing a survey or attending a planning meeting so that everyone can work together to build a sustainable, resilient Gary. The Climate Action Plan will identify ambitious yet achievable greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets for community activities, local government, and businesses. The Climate Action Plan and a detailed report will be completed by late 2021. Scott Henry says the Climate Action Plan strategies may include energy efficiency improvements for housing and neighborhoods, flooding and stormwater management, local food sustainability, air quality improvements, and waste reduction. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte, and tomorrow we will have David Wright with the GPTC with us to talk about the changes that are coming up, improvements on the transit service beginning next week. Hope you can join us.